This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, an update on the Flint water crisis. It's been 3 years since catastrophic lead levels were detected in the city's drinking water, and we will check in on the recovery process. But first, the pit viper is the most sensitive heat-detecting animal in nature. It uses specialized organs on the viper's head to detect and target its warm-blooded prey from a distance. But researchers at Caltech have made a material even more temperature-sensitive than that. It's developed from pectin, a sugar molecule found in fruit like apples. Well, why is this interesting? Well, you might use it to improve the temperature sensitivity, let's say, of prosthetic skin. There are all kinds of uses. How would you use it? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce the person who is working on this. Chiara D'Araio is professor of mechanical engineering at Caltech and co-author of the study published in Science Robotics. Dr. D'Araio, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm intrigued about what led you to discover this extremely heat-sensitive material.
Well, this was the result of a research journey that really, in my mind, is the characteristic story of a serendipitous discoveries. We actually started out our research with the goal of creating artificial wood, which would combine plant cells with synthetic nanostructures like carbon nanotubes, which are tiny structures that we can grow in the lab made of rolled up graphene. When we were testing these synthetic woods, we noted that the woods were very temperature sensitive, and that has led us to discover that pectin, a molecule that, as you say, is very commonly found in many plant cells. It's in fact a molecule that's in a structural molecule on plant cell walls, is extremely sensitive to temperature changes. So we decided to capitalize on that and try to extract these active molecules and synthesize flexible thin films with record-breaking temperature responsivities.
When you say it's heat sensitive, what happens to the pectin? Does it change color? How do you know it's detecting the heat?
So pectin is actually a molecule that's composed of it's a structural polysaccharide. It's a sugar, and it's composed of weakly bonded double strands molecules, like DNA. But instead, the structure is linked by calcium ions that are positively charged. When temperature increases, the molecule unzips, a bit like the zipper of a jacket, releasing the calcium ions in the surroundings and increasing their mobility. That, in turn, causes the overall electrical resistivity of pectin films to decrease as temperature increases. And we can correlate basically the conductivity changes with the external temperature just with the simple measurements with a multimeter.
Wow, and what is the range of temperature that it can detect?
Right now we have tested it between 5 and 45 degrees Celsius, which is generally it's the temperature in which biomolecules and biological cells survive. That's it's the temperature range where we live, where plants live, or where vipers, for example, hunt. Part of the reasons why we're limited between these relatively low temperatures is the fact that pectin films contain water, and at higher temperature, water starts to either bubble or evaporate, and that reduces the performance of temperature sensitivity in these films.
So you mentioned how pectin is used structurally in the plant, but it must also now be a temperature thermometer for the plant itself.
So this is still an open question. Actually, the fact that pectin is so temperature sensitive is something we found out a couple of years ago when we were studying these synthetic woods. It was not surprisingly, actually, given that pectin is so used in the food industry, it was not known that it is so sensitive to temperature changes. I believe the mechanisms for plant sensitivity is a lot more complex, although it's been known since the 50s and 60s that plants like trees are capable to detect temperature changes in an extremely sensitive way. Now, if it's only pectin or there are more complex ionic mechanisms that allow for plants sensitivity, that's still an open question.
And I thought maybe it's the way it knows to be, drop its leaves or something. It's seasonal
right.
changes. That's
You're right. I think this was surprising to us. I think it is obvious that plants need to know or notice temperature changes because of the leaf exchanges. But even on a diurnal cycle, say between day and night, temperature sensitivity can help plants to regulate the water intake. So how much nutrients do they need? But the sensitivity we discovered in pectin is a lot higher than that. Just to give you a sense, it allows pectin films can detect, for example, the presence of warm bodies like a rabbit or a human body or a hand at a distance of up to a meter. Now, why plants would be able to detect such tiny temperature changes, like 1/1000th of a degree or so, it's mysterious to me.
Yeah, and as you say, it's even more sensitive than a viper.
In a way, yes. Actually, what we call the responsivity to temperature changes, which is just to say it's the changes in electrical conductivity as a function of the temperature change, it's very similar to the vipers. It's actually mimicking really the response of rattlesnake or rat snakes. Hmm. However, where the pectin films improve the performance of snakes or surpass snakes is the fact that it can operate in such a wide temperature range. So it's very sensitive between almost a 50 degrees temperature range, while vipers are optimized, I guess, their organs are optimized to hunt in very narrow temperature ranges around which they live, for example, in the desert.
Yeah, yeah. So now that you have this, you have the pectin that you know it changes electrical conductivity, can you apply it, like I was speculating, as to prosthetic skin, for example, to give people a feeling of warmth?
Absolutely. I think we're very excited about the discovery because we can explore many of its potential applications. I think one of the most reachable applications is for sure, like you said, in robotics or prosthetics, where these electronic skins can augment the sensitivities of robots, for example, to improve robot-human interactions, to help robots distinguish, for example, between a human and another robot. But in biomedical applications, where perhaps more interestingly to our daily life, synthetic skins could be used in prosthetic limbs so that we can restore our senses, for example, in amputees or people who underwent major burns.
Now, you know, I asked people to come up with ideas. We have already some flooding in. Let's go to the phones to Max in West Virginia. Hi, Max.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for having me on. Oh. I love your show.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I was thinking it might be useful for, like, computer screens or touchscreen devices where you don't actually have to touch the screen because it's sensitive enough to pick up on your body temperature, maybe.
Wow.
Yeah. Hi, Max. This is Chiara. Actually, this is a great suggestion, and indeed, we believe that's a possible application. You can map temperature on large areas, like electronic devices, for example, even at a distance. So the screen would be able to see or locate the position of your finger without touching it, in a way like a 3D non-touch screen for electronic applications. I think this is possible. It requires some complex signal processing, but it is not undoable.
Yeah, for home automation, you know.
People
walking around, animals, pets, things like that. Instead of infrared, is it an infrared sensor, basically, or is it?
No, so this is a tricky difference. The infrared sensing requires specific wavelengths to be detected by pectin, and pectin itself is quite transparent to infrared. So what it really is detecting is the temperature changes of the air surrounding the sensor due to radiated heat, basically by convection.
That's even more fantastic.
Yes, that's correct.
So you're pretty excited about this, I can tell.
Yeah, we look forward to continue this work and explore many different directions.
Do you have any business partnerships yet? Have you know, is this patented, this whole thing, or on its way?
We have patented it, and the patent has been submitted, and it's now undergoing the review process. We have not explored the commercialization yet.
Well, that may change after today, so stay by your cell phone. So where do you go next? What would you like to know that you don't know now, or what you tell me where you're headed?
Well, on the packing application itself, we would like to be able to stabilize it even at higher temperature ranges. Actually, in responses to Max's suggestion, you know, being able to push its limit of operation even beyond 45, 50 degrees now, for example, to reach about 80 or 90, would open yet another new range of potential applications, for example, in the consumer electronic industry, which requires broader temperature stabilities. So we're looking into that, into ways to stabilize these molecule and these films beyond the temperature currently studied. But we're also exploring different kinds of molecules that perhaps, you know, also possibly extracted from complex biological cells to directly capitalize on nature's own ability to synthesize these complex structures and use them in applications.
What led you down this research path toward developing synthetic wood and then the materials and all this kind of stuff?
In my research, I've been always fascinated about the discovery of new materials, because I believe that materials are really the seeds or the foundations of technological innovation. If you look at, you know, throughout human history, materials from the discovery of, you know, stone, bronze, iron, and so on have defined ages of technological innovations, up to the semiconductors, right, that allowed us to have all the technology we have today. Yeah. And I'm interested in finding the new materials that will enable the next set of technological innovations. And I am fascinated by biological world, because I believe that it offers wonderful and very widely open opportunities to synthesize new materials.
Now, we have one tweet coming in. It says, why not use the pectin film to sense bodies under rubble? Wow. Well, we'll leave that up to you, because I know that you're going to be researching this. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Chiara Daraio, who is a professor of mechanical engineering at Caltech and co-author of the study published in Science Robotics. We're going to take a break and come back. We're going to talk about Flint being without clean drinking water for over 1,000 days, and we'll look at how the lead levels have progressed since the start of the crisis. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan started nearly 3 years ago. Residents started noticing brown water flowing from their taps. Kids were testing positive for lead poisoning. Mayor Karen Weaver declared a state of emergency in December 2015. And the following month, the EPA and FEMA placed the city in a federal state of emergency that would last until that summer. Lead from pipes had been leaching into the drinking water. Some of the worst hit homes saw lead levels 10 times higher than the EPA limits. Since then, officials, residents, and researchers have been working to bring down the lead levels. And last month, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality test results showed that the drinking water in Flint fell under federal action levels. So residents are still advised to drink filtered or bottled water, but they are free to bathe in the water. How far had the lead levels come in Flint? What are the problems? What were the problems that led so much lead leak from the pipes? Are the towns, other towns, in danger too? But are they flying under the radar? We're going to talk all about the lead water crisis in Flint and possible ramifications and things that we have learned. Here to discuss this stuff with me are Lindsay Smith, a reporter with Michigan Public Radio. She's based out of Grand Rapids. Mark Edwards, professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Welcome to Science Friday. Lindsay, let me begin with you. You've reported on and followed this story pretty closely. Give us some background. Where were the details of the decision-making, what went into changing the water sources? Give us some idea of the background here. Lindsay, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
10-4. So this is a big question you've thrown at me here.
Well, take it apart, piece by piece.
How long do you have?
Tell us about some of the history of the decision making that went into changing the water sources. How did this start out?
So this started out under a state emergency manager, which Flint had because of their sort of dire finances. And the emergency managers at the time, which is an appointee of the governor. So this is not an elected official, which is why you get a lot of pushback about the decision-making process. So the state officials, in an attempt to try to save the city money, because Flint pays some of the highest water bills in the nation, they tried to make a switch to this new water system that is still under construction. And because the new system was still under construction, there was sort of this back and forth between the city of Detroit, which is where Flint buys its water from Detroit. And basically they're, you know, Detroit, when Flint said, we're going to go to this new system, Detroit didn't take it so well. They were also going through a bankruptcy at the time, and to lose a big customer like that, they weren't pleased. So they said, well, if you want to go to this other system, well, then we're going to charge you more. So instead of agreeing to pay this more money to Detroit, the emergency manager said, okay, well, we'll go to the Flint River and get our water from the river. But in doing that, they didn't upgrade the water treatment plant to be able to properly treat that water. And they didn't add corrosion control, which is something that's really important in a city like Flint, where you have these old lead service lines. They're really common in older cities. And so that sort of is how we had this lead contamination over 18 months. Wow. That water that wasn't treated properly really kind of messed up the pipes and leached that lead from not only the service lines, but old plumbing in people's houses and that sort of a thing.
Mark Edwards, the city did eventually start putting the corrosion control chemical into the water. Why won't the pipes just form another layer and the system sort of heal itself?
It will, from the perspective of water quality. That is, the extent that this coating keeps lead out of the water and you're protecting the water from the iron pipe, which is eating up the disinfectant. However, there is damage that was done during this time period that's irreversible. Specifically, corrosion eats holes in metals. It weakens pipes. And so to some extent during this time, there were massive outbreaks of water main breaks. Literally, the water was eating holes through the iron pipes. And that damage cannot be undone, both to the city's big pipes, the water mains, but also to some small extent that we probably can't quantify, to the plumbing, the water heaters, and other devices in the consumer's home.
Mm-hmm. Now, according to the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, Flint lead levels fall under a federal action level. But residents still can't drink the water without a filter, right? So what does that benchmark really tell us about the water, how safe it is?
Well, what it tells you is a higher standard is currently being applied in Flint than anywhere else in the United States, and with good reason, because the public trust was betrayed, and we have criminal indictments that have occurred here because federal law was not being followed. So even though these levels of lead that are currently in Flint's water are not worse than many other U.S. cities with old lead pipe, people are very reluctant to remove the public health protections that are in place, specifically the use of bottled water filters. So until the lead levels go lower and a reasonable amount of time has passed, no one's going to declare that this water is as safe as other U.S. cities and that people should drink it, but rather it is in the range of other U.S. cities, but we're encouraging people to continue using the free filters that the state and the feds are providing just to provide that extra measure of health protection.
Lindsay, there is a lawsuit out now about providing access to water and filters. Tell us about that.
Well, there's about 1,700 lawsuits. This is just one of many. I mean, in serious though, there's a ton of lawsuits. Mm-hmm. There is one in particular right now where a group of residents and the Natural Resources Defense Council are asking a federal judge to force the state and the city to deliver bottled water or make sure, like send a team of people, experts to people's houses to make sure that people's filters are properly installed and are working. These filters that the state gives away are these like ones that clip on your faucet. And it's not, it seems easy maybe to do, but not everybody is able to do that and get them to work properly. And you have to replace the cartridges every so often. So there's concern that these filters aren't being installed properly by people, you know, normal people that are trying to put them in their sink. The judge has not, well, at first they ruled, he ruled to force the state to do that. But now that the water is under the action limit, the state is arguing that that shouldn't be necessary.
Right. Right. Let's go to the phones. If you'd like to call 844-724-8255. Let's go to Tent City, Missouri. Hi, Susie. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I just have a question about what type of filtration system that you need to get for your house. If you don't have like a faucet filter and you want to do a whole house filtration system, is it like reverse osmosis or what type of filtration system is that?
Are you fearful in your own home about lead?
No, but we have problems in southern Missouri with lead, and I have friends that live in southern Missouri, and there's a lot of people down there that could be affected, so I'm just curious what they can do.
Good question. Mark, you want to talk about that?
About 40% of all water customers around the country, through some reason of personal preference, decide to use some sort of filter. And the reasons are varied. It could be that their water is too hard and they want to make it softer, in which case an RO filter is appropriate.
Reverse osmosis.
Right. Yeah. It could be that they're worried about lead, in which case an end-of-faucet filter is the best approach because it cleans the water that passes through all the lead pipes, and there's no chance that the water will get contaminated after it flows from the faucet into your cup or cooking utensil. There's also people concerned about aesthetic issues, which might involve using a sediment filter, a whole house filter that just removes particles. But we do point out that these filters do have some drawbacks, especially the whole house filters. One of the biggest problems that we realize we have in this country in recent years is bad bacteria that grow in plumbing systems that can kill you. And that was something that manifested itself in Flint. 12 people died from one of the worst waterborne outbreaks of Legionella in U.S. history. And these whole house filters sometimes have triggered Legionella bacteria levels to increase in home plumbing. So we're a little bit reluctant to recommend these things. A lot of it's on personal preference and the water in your system. And to some extent, those end-of-faucet filters are very safe because they're not messing up the water that's sitting in the rest of your plumbing system. You're cleaning it up right before you use it, and you can do relatively little harm to yourself by installing these filters and actually do yourself a lot of good.
Yeah, that's a good point. If I can, we get this question a lot from Flint residents. Should I do a whole house filter? Doesn't that just seem like a better idea than these ones that go on your faucet? But kind of what Mark was saying here is that up until even 2014, their lead-free faucet pieces and fixtures could also have a percentage of lead in them and be considered lead-free. So even though you may be filtering your water when it comes into your home, there's all these fixtures and pipes inside of your home that you could leach stuff from after it goes through that whole house filter.
Not to mention the lead solder in some of the pipes.
Exactly.
Right.
Let me bring on another guest, because if the lead pipes are the problem, isn't the answer to just pull them out? Yeah, well, it's easier said than done. Money, of course, is a big issue, but the problem is even more basic than cost. How about we don't even know where the pipes are? My next guest looked into this situation. Martin Kaufman is an environmental hydrologist, professor of earth sciences at the University of Michigan in Flint. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Let's talk about it. You made a map of the lead service pipes in Flint, but you had trouble finding the records. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, we found the records. We had trouble with the quality of the data in the records. The city of Flint had used paper maps to record an indicator on parcel maps, 240 of them, what type of pipe was servicing a parcel in the city. There are 56,000 property parcels in the city of Flint, and they marked each one with a code. For instance, L was indicative of a lead service line. L to C was indicative of a copper to lead or lead to copper connection. And they put a diameter of the pipe for those that were galvanized. There are 11,000 missing records out of the 56,000. Now remember, these data were only recorded until 1984, and they were put on paper maps. So when we approached the city to help them put this in digital format, we stitched together all 240 maps and scanned them. And then we created a procedure and a geographic information system to transfer the code from the paper map onto a real parcel database. So that gave us a preliminary indication based on these data at the time of where the lead service line, where lead existed in the service line system within Flint.
Mm-hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. With so many tens of thousands of service lines, you can't remove every single one of them, can you, Mark?
Well, you could.
Actually, a couple cities have. Madison, Wisconsin, and Lansing, Michigan have undergone voluntary service line removal. Up to about 8,000 service lines have been removed in those cities. But they didn't do it under emergency conditions. Mm-hmm. Mark, you're going to say something?
Well, and even in Washington, D.C., when the city resolved that they were going to replace every single lead line in public space, what they realized is the way they were doing it was actually lead poisoning children, because you're cutting a hazardous material and chunks of lead were going into people's houses for a long time afterwards. And the more they looked, the more lead pipes they found. And so eventually they spent $100 million, actually increased the incidence of lead poisoning, and found more lead pipes than they'd ever imagined, and they just gave up.
Hmm. So who's footing the cost for all these replacements in these different states?
It's always the ratepayer. Through your water bills, you're one way or another paying for this, except for the part that's on the private line. The city will offer you to replace it at cost, but what was happening in D.C. was people were getting the offer to pay $5,000 to replace their part of the lead pipe. Less than 1% of the people did that. And so this is actually creating a long-term problem, in that the city's records indicate there's no lead pipe. You've also disturbed the lead pipe, and you've connected to copper, and actually you've left the situation worse than you found it in many cases. And the city has replaced its part of the lead plumbing and charged you through your rates.
Yeah, I read this. There's a kind of an important point here that not everybody grasps when I talk to people, is that the service line that goes from the water main to your house, part of it is in most cities owned by the public, like in the easement, that's the city-owned portion. But then the part that's on your property line, that's yours. That's your responsibility in most cases. And so what Mark is talking about here, that in D.C., you know, they went in and did partial replacements, which can make things worse.
And in Lansing, they actually own the whole lead pipe. That was one advantage they had to getting all of their lead pipes out of the ground.
But how certain are you, Martin, that you know where all the pipes are?
We're not.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem. You know, again, one-fifth of the records that we're missing. We've got a lot of pipes that right now we don't know if there's lead in them or not. To date, the city has dug up 800 pipes. So a couple professors from Ann Arbor have put together a simulation program based upon the data that has been acquired so far to try to predict where there might be lead pipes within the system. And as we gather more data from the excavations and from inspections within the home, our process of identifying where the pipes are will become better.
All right, we're going to take a break. Can I ask all of you to hang with us while we go through the break and come back and talk lots more about this? We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the lead levels in the Flint water system and, you know, maybe some more suggestions about what to do about it. We would love to hear from you. Our number 844-724-8255. If you live in Flint or in Michigan or another city where you think there's a lead problem, you can dial us 844-724-8255. Tweet us at SciFry. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you have just joined us, we're talking about the continuing problems with the drinking water in Flint, Michigan. With my guest, Lindsay Smith, a reporter with Michigan Public Radio, Mark Edwards, professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech, Martin Kaufman, an environmental hydrologist, professor of earth sciences at the University of Michigan. In Flint, our number is 844-724-8255. Dr. Kaufman, the city's official tally for the number of lead service pipes they're going to remove is 28,100 service lines. Now, that's a much higher number than what you came up with. Well, what accounts for the difference?
Well, when we looked at our estimate was based only on that 1984 data. Remember, we had 11,000 pipes which were of unknown origin in terms of the material, and also around 13,000 which were classified as galvanized. So the city's estimate includes the galvanized pipes and also probably some of the unknown as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason for the disparity.
Let's go to the phones to Washington, D.C., to Miriam. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of your show, and my dad is a Mira XL, so my whole family is, you know, really big fans.
Well, I wanted
to ask your guest about the role of citizen science. I mean, you're talking about these huge gaps in the data, and, you know, it seems like a lot of work to both track where the lead is, and I was just wondering what the role of citizen science and crowd science is in dealing with the huge amount of data.
Good question. Anybody want to take a whack, Mark? Any idea here?
Well, one thing consumers can do is to go and try to identify the material that's coming into their basement or the part of the service line that is coming into their house. There's videos on the internet that tell you how to determine if that's a lead pipe. And the one thing you can be sure is if you have a lead pipe coming into your house, you have a very significant health risk. What you can't be sure of is if you have a copper or a galvanized iron pipe coming into your house, that there's a lead pipe somewhere out there that you don't see. And so for that, you need the city to come and usually dig a hole in your yard, unfortunately, because as Martin said, the records are so bad, they don't even know where the lead pipes are.
Wow. We have a tweet here from Elizabeth. She says, I live in Pittsburgh. Reports that we might be headed the way of Flint. Any information for us?
Well, I could speak to that. Pittsburgh actually has admitted that they're over the lead and copper rule. And, of course, there's concerns that they've been hiding lead and water problems going back to 2013. But they're trying hard to get good corrosion control in place, and you should follow the city's advice to flush your water or use bottled water or filter, especially if you have a lead pipe. It's official that Pittsburgh has too much lead in their water according to federal standards. They have worse lead than Flint right now.
Well, let me ask, what about the whole country? I mean, these can't be just outliers, can they? I mean, there's a very old water system in this country.
Well, in the aftermath of Flint, what we've discovered is that in most cities, when we looked at the records and how they're sampling, that in many cases they were falsely reassuring people that their water was safe when it wasn't. So there's been exposés by The Guardian, by USA Today, and realizes that this spans the range from our biggest cities to our post-industrial cities to rural America. There was a front-page USA Today report in December of last year. So this is why everyone is kind of upset about Flint, because they have learned they can't trust the water supply in their own city in many cases.
Lindsay, are cities in Michigan monitoring their drinking water differently because of what happened in Flint?
Many cities are, yeah. We've seen cities like Detroit and Kalamazoo test ahead of schedule. If you're following the lead and copper rule, a lot of cities are on this reduced monitoring schedule. So they only have to test for lead once every 3 years and a limited number of homes, too. So you're not getting nearly the amount of data that you are in Flint's case, for instance. So in Detroit, Kalamazoo, they tested a year ahead of time. They weren't supposed to test until this coming summer, but they tested last summer. And then the other thing, a lot of things that I'm seeing across the board or in cities that kind of have their, as my grandma would say, their poop in a group, you know, they are checking their records to make sure that they are in some semblance of an order. And Detroit and Kalamazoo also checked the homes that they did for compliance testing. They did what Mark said, basically send somebody into the basement to check that line and not just go off of the records or the list that they've used in previous testing years. They're actually verifying that they are testing the homes that they're supposed to. And that is, it's such a key because, I mean, in Detroit's case, as an example, I mean, that's the biggest city in Michigan, and it has the by far the most lead service lines of any city that in the state. And they were determining where lead service lines were based on the year that the home was built or the year that the home had attached to the water main. So if your home was built before 1948 that they went by, but it's somewhere around that range. If it was before then they counted you as a lead service line, but they didn't necessarily know that. They just went off of that number. So in those cases, you know, you may be testing homes that are not going to even show you the dangers. So I think we're seeing more testing and we're seeing some cities going out and verifying and sort of doing that work that should have been done in the 90s when the lead and copper rule got passed.
Let me go out to South Bend, Indiana to Brian. Hi, welcome to Science Friday, Brian.
Hey, good afternoon. So it was my understanding that when lead pipes were in use, the water municipality or the water district would have an additive to the water, some kind of ion that would oxidize the lead so that the water through the pipe wasn't leaching any, you know, lead particles out of it. And so in Flint's case, when they switched to the Flint River, those additives weren't in the water. Is that accurate? And if so, are there chemical solutions that we can look at rather than kind of the tear out and replace tack that most cities are looking at?
So yes, that's called corrosion control. And the general idea of corrosion control is to add a chemical to the water that keeps the lead on the pipe and out of the water. And this is a very important public health intervention. It's how we reduce lead in water across the country, regardless of service line material. But what we've realized in the last few years is that this isn't a very imperfect Band-Aid. And even in the best of circumstances, little pieces of lead are sometimes falling into water, creating a health risk. And so we once thought we could do a very good job protecting the public and make the water safe, even if they have a lead pipe. And in the aftermath of Flint, what we now realize is that's not the case, that probably we're never going to be able to say that it's safe to drink water from a lead pipe, not only in Flint, but in fact, all around the United States. And so probably you're going to see more emphasis on lead pipe replacement and use of these filters to protect people. So corrosion control is an important Band-Aid, but it doesn't solve the problem.
Mark, you published a study last week that looked at lead, not only the lead pipes, but also galvanized pipes. What did this tell you about how lead flowed through the system?
Well, what we discovered in Flint is that some of the worst houses actually had a lead pipe followed by a galvanized iron pipe. And what had happened over the almost a century some of these pipes had been in the ground is the iron rust on the galvanized iron pipe sponged up lead at very, very high levels. And when the corrosion control was discontinued, that iron rust fell off with a lot of lead coming with it. And that probably created the worst health danger in Flint. So ironically, even though the lead pipe was the source of most of the lead problems that we think we saw during the crisis, it was this particular configuration where you had an iron pipe followed by the lead pipe where people were at greatest risk.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just sum up in the last minute we have then. So then what I'm hearing is that you're saying the only solution is to rip out the pipes and replace them, and until you do that, to get your water filtered.
That's correct. That's what's being recommended in Flint right now, bottled water, use of filters, or otherwise you're risking your family from the health effects of these lead pipes.
I want to thank all of you for taking time to be with us today. Lindsay Smith, reporter with Michigan Public Radio in Grand Rapids. Mark Edwards, professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg, Virginia. Martin Kaufman, a professor of earth sciences at the University of Michigan in Flint. Thank you all for taking time today. They say these days there's a pill for everything. Well, it is a bit of an exaggeration. And now researchers have taken things a step further. Ingestible sensors, tiny devices that you swallow that collect health data from inside your digestive tract. They are just prototypes so far, being tested in pigs. But to make them viable, you have to find a way to power the devices. Well, why not use the gastric juices found in the stomach? A battery that runs on stomach acid. Hello. And that's just what my next guest did. Giovanni Traverso, a gastroenterologist and biomedical engineer at Brigham and Women's Hospital, also a research affiliate at MIT. Dr. Traverso, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
What would be a good use for these ingestible sensors?
Yeah, you know, great question. And, you know, I think it's worth just taking a step back. And, you know, the thing that we're really interested in is exploring the concept of having systems inside of the GI tract for a variety of applications, including sensing, but then also drug delivery. So, you know, but really when you start thinking about keeping a system inside of the body for a long time, as you highlighted, powering that system becomes a challenge. And that's exactly what we tried to aim to address here with this study.
Did a little light bulb go off and somebody said, hey, you know, the stomach's full of acid. We make a battery. We have an electrolyte sitting right there.
So, you know, we're very fortunate. We were collaborating with a group of electrical engineers at MIT, and we started sort of exploring a couple of ideas. And, you know, I think thinking back to sort of the high school days, one of the concepts was sort of applying the lessons from the lemon battery. And you know, and recognizing that there is an acidic environment in the stomach, you know, really motivated sort of further development down that path.
Has this idea already been tried in animals to see how well it works?
Absolutely. So, you know, we showed in pigs that we could actually power these systems for almost a week. And before this work, the longest that had been achieved through systems was more in the order of minutes to about an hour. And so, you know, we're really encouraged by the possibility of long-term powering of such systems.
And is that the time that you would need, just minutes to an hour? So,
well, you know, the kinds of things that we're interested in are really monitoring and providing sort of these sensors from within on the order of weeks and potentially even months following a single ingestion. Mm-hmm.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Giovanni Traverso of MIT and Brigham and Women's Hospital. So what about differences in diet? Would you be facing, you know, challenges when people swallow it and eat stuff? Would it interfere with the, you know, the acid?
You know, the great question. And so part of the reason that we wanted to test these in a large mammal, you know, was to start to address that. And what we observed, at least over the course of a week, and, you know, these animals were going about their daily business as they would otherwise, eating and drinking their food. And, you know, we were encouraged by overall the amount of power that we were able to harvest period. But, you know, I think absolutely as part of the next set of studies, that certainly would be one of the aspects that we would look at specifically, you know, how much energy is available to be harvested during those times of feeding versus ones, you know, during fasting times.
Now, I would imagine if with all the battery in there and the electronics and the sensing materials, you've got a pretty big pill, or as my dad used to say, a horse pill.
You know, and in this case, I guess it was more of a pig pill, but it was a little bit, you know, but this was a prototype and it was on the larger side. But, you know, it was the first prototype that was made. And this was the initial concept was it was built with off-the-shelf components. And so certainly we see the possibility of significant reduction in size for, you know, for the next step, this next stage of development.
Now, does the pills, is it made to just stay in the stomach acid in the stomach, or can it actually travel past it into the small intestine?
So these actually could make it out of the body, and they did. And actually we monitored the animals until these passed out of the GI tract. And one of the interesting things that we did was actually to characterize how much energy could be harvested from the stomach and whether we could harvest from the small intestine. And even though it's not acidic, we actually showed that there is some energy that can be harvested from the intestine, which I think is also an encouraging observation here for future systems in the body.
I imagine you would also have to make it the right shape so that it does pass through the system, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, depending on what the goal was, and so some of our work actually has to do with having systems stay in the stomach for prolonged periods of time, and then either having that shape change, for example, to enable the transit through the body. So it really depends on the kind of time that you're interested in monitoring, for example, an individual.
And the things that you could monitor, what, the heart rate or how much acid is in the stomach? What other kinds of things?
Absolutely. So, you know, the first thing we showed here in this study was temperature. And, you know, we communicated that to an external receiver over the course of the week. But we've done some other work in the past looking at measuring heart rate, respiratory rate. And we're doing some other work looking at movement of the actual GI tract and then sensing different proteins and toxins, you know, to help serve as systems for early detection.
I guess, as you say, you could engineer it to stay or move around where you'd like it to be, and maybe even self-dissolve, depending on how you design it?
Exactly. No, and that's, you know, a lot of the work that we do is on material development and thinking about materials that you can, for example, trigger to dissolve on a certain time scale or to dissolve near immediately to exactly as you said, to enable the passage down the GI tract.
And to give off any medicines it might have in it.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly.
I see nano words here coming to mind, nanotechnology stuff. Thank you very much, Dr. Traverso.
Thank you.
Giovanni Traverso is a gastroenterologist and a biomedical engineer at Brigham and Women's Hospital as a research affiliate at MIT. One last thing before we go. What's more important for Valentine's Day than the chemistry that you share with your Valentine? Well, we've made some science-themed Valentines that are perfect for that special nerd in your life. You can print them out and see all sorts of Cupid-themed science at sciencefriday.com/valentines. sciencefriday.com/valentines. Cute stuff. I think you'll really enjoy it. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. Happy Valentine's Day. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.